Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. If you've got your Bibles this morning, we're going to turn to the book of Psalms again today. We'll be in Psalm 80. Psalm 80 today. We're going to read, we'll read the entire passage here in just a minute. Last week, as we continued in our look at the Christmas in Psalms, we read Psalm 33, and we looked at the idea of hope, and that God is one, the ultimate one that we can hope in. And the world, we saw the world offers us a lot of false hopes that in the end only breach the contract they make with us because they can't hold up their end of the bargain. So, we saw then at the end that God is the only faithful and just and true one that holds up those hope or is able to come through on what He promises. And so at the end of the day, it was a very uplifting psalm. It was a very encouraging psalm. But today, we kind of change tunes. And today, our psalm is not an uplifting and joyful one, but it is on the other end of the life spectrum. Right, it's a. I'm not musical. I don't play an instrument. Pastor Adam does all that, but I do know this little bit, that there's a difference between major key songs and minor key songs. Right, if you don't know what I'm talking about, I need you to do this. And if we've been able to, we could have done it this morning. But I need you to go on YouTube. And I need you to put in John Denver's, what song is it? I can't think of the name of it. Anyway, Minor Key. Just you can do Google that. And you'll come up with a picture of John Denver that looks like it's altered because the original picture is him smiling. And this one, he has this massive frown on his face. And it's a very well-known song. The name of it escapes me, but it sounds awful. The original song is happy and upbeat. Take Me Home, Country Roads. That's it. All right. You know, it's like, hey, yeah, yeah. And you listen to the minor key song, and it automatically makes you go, oh. Like you get to the chorus part that's all uplifting and upbeat and all that, and you're waiting for it to get to that point, and you get to it, and it's like, oh, I just feel sad. It's like a dark cloud. I listened to it this week, and I knew it was coming. And I was like, this is just so sad. Right, well, last week's psalm was like the major key psalm. It's the, hey, and this week's is the, oh, no. But in each of them, just like last week, this week, there is something for us to learn. Because if you've lived life any length of time, you know that life is not always the major key song, is it? Sometimes, in fact, much of life may be decided what's happening on the minor key end of the spectrum, right? All right, so let's read Psalm 80 and we'll get into it. All right, to the choir master, according to the lilies, a testimony of Asaph, a psalm. So Asaph is the writer of this entire psalm. Here we go, verse 1. Give ear, O shepherd of Israel, you who lead Joseph like a flock, you who are enthroned upon the cherubim, shine forth before Ephraim and Benjamin and Manasseh, stir up your might and come to save us. Verse 3, restore us, O God, let your face shine that we may be saved. O Lord God of hosts, how long will you be angry with your people's prayers? You have fed them with the bread of tears and given them tears to drink in full measure. You make us an object of contention for our neighbors, and our enemies laugh among themselves. Verse 7, restore us, O God of hosts, let your face shine that we may be saved. You brought a vine out of Egypt. You drove out the nations and planted it. You cleared the ground for it. It took deep root and filled the land. The mountains were covered with its shade. The mighty cedars with its branches. It sent out its branches to the sea, and its shoots to the river. Why then have you broken down its walls so that all who pass along the way pluck its fruit? The boar from the forest ravages it, and all that move in the field feed on it. Verse 14, turn again, O God of hosts. Look down from heaven and see, have regard for this vine, the stock that your right hand planted, and for the son whom you made strong for yourself. Verse 16, they have burned it with fire. They have cut it down. May they perish at the rebuke of your face. But let your hand, but let your hand be on the man of your right hand and the son of man whom you have made strong for yourself. Then we shall not turn back from you. Give us life and we will call upon your name. Restore us, O Lord God of hosts. Let your face shine that we may be saved. All right, let's get into it. Now, we've said for the last several weeks that the opening portions of Psalm kind of give us the direction of the Psalm. And this again plays out true today. Verses 1 and 2, you immediately can tell something's wrong because the author says, give ear, O shepherd of Israel. So what the author is trying to do is he say, if we were writing this today, we'd say, hey God, listen up. I got something I'm trying to tell you. Are you hearing me? Hey, I don't know where you at, but hey, I'm saying something here. And so the author is pleading, he's begging, if you will, for God to listen to what he's trying to say. Now, he's going to invoke several images in this passage. And this first image is that of a shepherd. And he says, remember, like he plays into that shepherd imagery and says, hey, God, you are our shepherd. You're our leader. Like, we are your flock, and you led us, and you were enthroned, and you were great. Hey, listen up. I got something to say. Can you hear me today? Right? And so, that's a much different tone than last week, right? Immediately, your ears should perk up when you read verse 1 and 2 and go, uh-oh, something's happened. I don't know what it is yet, but something's happened. And then in verse 3, we get the theme of the psalm. Restore us, O God. Let your face shine that we may be saved. Now, we're going to spend just a minute or two on, maybe more than a minute or two, on this passage because you've got to get this. You want to know why? Because this is the theme of the song. But more than that, I don't know if you've heard it or not, but Asaph repeats this two more times. In verse 7 and in verse 19. So 3, 7, and 19. Now look, when I was a young child, my pastor said, if the Bible says it once, it's important. Bible says it twice, it's doubly important. But Lord have mercy, if it says it three times, you best listen up. And here today, in this one passage, the author says three times, restore us, O God. And then in verse 7, he says, God of hosts, let your face shine that we may be saved. So if you don't hear nothing else today, I hope you listen to the rest of it. You got to get this passage to understand this psalm because this is the theme of the psalm. So let's talk about it. What does he mean, restore us? Restore us means to bring back into relationship. It is bringing back something. So it's you lost something, you misplaced something, you gave something away, something got away from you, and you bring it back to you. And so in this context, it is Asaph is talking about God bringing back into relationship the people of Israel. So what does that mean at the beginning? What we can answer this question right now. From Asaph's perspective, he feels like Israel is not in relationship with God. Because you don't have to bring something back if you already got it, right? You don't have to restore something if it ain't broke, right? This is not preventive maintenance. This is something is broke and it needs to be fixed, All right. So from the outset, we know from Asa's perspective that Israel and God are not on the same page. Israel is not in relationship. And Asa is desperately pleading for God to bring them back into relationship with him. But that's not it. Because then he says this little unique phrase. It says, "Let your face shine that we may be saved." Now, that's an interesting way to say that. We would not necessarily choose those phrasings to kind of give reference to us being back into relationship with God, but Asa does, and there's a reason. Because this little phrasing is almost a direct quote from Numbers chapter 6. And so if you go read Numbers chapter 6, verse 25, you will read this: "The Lord make His face to shine upon you and be gracious to you." Right? And so here's what the context for that. So God speaks those words, "Lord make His face shine upon you and be gracious to you," to Moses. And Moses is to then tell Aaron, his brother, and Aaron's son, so his nephews, and then Aaron and his sons, who are the priests of Israel in Numbers, are then supposed to go and share this message with the people. And this is the beginning. There's more after this in Numbers. But this is the opening for the, they're supposed to share this with the people. And so in Numbers, it is a general blessing over the nation. And so what Asaph is doing is saying, "God, this ain't happening right now. Your face is not shining upon us. This is not happening. And so you need to restore us back so that your face will shine upon us once again." And so restoration for Israel and Asaph's mindset equals God's face shining upon them. Now, that's great, but we still got to worry about what does this mean, right? Because that's, again, a weird phrase that we wouldn't use. And so what that phrase means is in essence, Asaph asking God to bring back His blessing, His protection, His goodness, His warmth, and His provision on them. In short, Asaph is saying, "God, restore us to the place of Your blessing. Because right now, we ain't in it." Now, before we go on, let me just say this. There's a question we're going to have to ask in just a minute. Okay? A very important question we're going to have to ask, because it gets us into the next portion of the main teaching section of this psalm. But before we do, I do want to take just a second, and I do want you to realize, again, I've already teed this up, but you've got to realize not only what this passage means, we just did that, it's God restoring them back to His place of blessing. That's what Asaph's asking for. But you got to understand the importance of this phrase, because it's not said once, not twice, but three times. And so what you need to realize is, by Asaph putting this passage in verse number 3 and verse number 19, which is what does that do? It bookends the passage. Right? The main teaching is about to come. We ain't got to that part yet. This is just the theme that weaves its way through. And so the main teaching's to come. And so by Asaph putting this phrase at bookends, What that means for us is, it means for the readers, is that this needs to be the lens through which we read this entire passage. So whatever Asaph's going to say in the middle, which we're about to talk about, it needs to be seen through the lens of, "God, restore us to the place of Your blessing." And so he bookends it with that to drive that point home. But then he puts it in the middle in verse number 7. And so when we read it in verse 7, it's then a constant reminder that God is a restorer who brings people back to the place of blessing. So again, I can't stress enough the importance of this idea of God bringing back people into the place of blessing. It's a bookend for this chapter, and it's a constant reminder as we read. Okay? Everybody good? All right, so let's go on. Now, the question that we must answer is, for what do they need restoration from? Because again, we've established you only need to restore something if it ain't fixed already or if it's broke. What is the driver then? What's the cause? Now, I'm going to be honest with you. Listen to me. If you and I, in 2022, were writing the main portion of this passage, we would not write it in the order that Asaph does. Okay? For example, because this is what you usually do. When you tell a story, all right, or when you explain, maybe that's not the best way to say it. When you explain what has happened, here's what you do. All right? I'm standing in the present right now. The future's over there. The past is over here. Here's what you normally do. You go way over here to the distant past and say, hey, everything was like this back then. Then you go to the nearer past or the more recent past and you say, but then this happened. And then you go to the present and you say, and then I'm right here. And then you talk about the future. Right? So you go further past, recent past, present, future. That's how you would tell this story. Because that's what we do. Because we are chronological and it needs to be in order and all of that. And so that's what you would do. You would tell the far past, the recent past, the present, then the future. Listen to me. That is not the order that Asaph is going to tell the what had happened was section of this story, okay? He's not going to do that. He completely reorders it. And so you just need to go that. Here's Asaph's order. He's going to tell us about the present. Then he's going to tell us about the distant past. Then he's going to tell us about the recent past. Then he's going to tell us about the future. So he starts here. Then he jumps way down here. Then he goes here. And then he ends up way over here. Okay? So again, it's not the order that you would tell us, but that's okay because it's the order that he chooses. Okay? So I need you to understand that first. So what's the first thing he talks about? The present in verses 4 through 6. And here's the phrase. And if you have never read the Psalms, you are missing out because you will read this phrase over and over. How long, oh Lord? Let me translate to you. God, you up there doing anything? We waiting. How long are you going to make us wait down here? Right, it's like kids on a vacation trip. We there yet? We there? 5, 10 minutes later. How much longer? It was the same, minus 10 minutes. 5 hours. We got to where we told our kids in movies, it's three movies. You need to watch three movies. It's three movies long. That's our guess. Oh, that's not that long. And of course, about halfway through the first one. Hey, how much longer? How far are you through with that movie? 2.5 more then. Let's go. Right? But that's how we are with God, right? God, how much longer are you going to make us wait up here? Like, how long do we? And so he's like, God, we are not in a great place. Like, are you hearing us? What's going on? What are you doing? And then in a beautifully painful illustration, in verse 5, he tells us, in verse 5 and 6, he tells us the absolute desperation that Israel's in. Read verse 5 with me again. He says, You have fed, and God, you have fed them, us, with the bread of tears and given them tears to drink in full measure. What does that mean? That bread of tears idea is basically insinuating that they have fed themselves with their tears. Their only food is that which they cry. And the only thing that quenches their thirst, or that they have to quench their thirst, is their tears. A beautifully painful illustration of where Israel is at. And then to make matters worse, verse 6 says that they are an object of contention. What that means is, instead of Israel being a kingdom of priests and a holy nation that should be leading their neighbors to God, their neighbors are in essence saying this: I thought y'all was God's people over there. What's going on? Oh, so is this what happens? Oh, I thought you were a holy nation. Look what's going on now. And to make matters worse, instead of running to God by Israel's example, they're now running away, and they've become a laughingstock in the neighborhood, so to speak. Right? And so the picture that Asaph paints is one of total desperation. total desperation. That's where we're at. But then Asaph says in verses 8 and following, he says, that's not the way it used to be. Right? So he jumps way back to the distant past. He says, but that's not how it's always been. And then he uses this idea, this image of a vineyard owner planting grapevines. And he says that God is the great vine dresser. That's a really weird way, but that's what you call someone who works with grapes and works with vines. So he says it's this great vine dresser who has planted Israel like this amazing grapevine. And he's done so well, and he's watered it and protected it and nourished it and done so much good and taken care of and cultivated and took out the weeds and fertilized and watered and all that this grapevine has grown so large, listen to me, that it covers the mountains. That's pretty big, right? It covers the mountains, and look, it shades all the other trees. In other words, in a time past, Israel has been a place of nourishment, provision, and protection, even for their neighbors. But that ain't today. But it ain't always been like it was today. In the distant past, we were doing what God created us to do, so to speak, the nation of Israel. And then he moves to the recent past. In verses 12, 13, and verse 16, he says, but now, or just recently, the fruit, the vine, fruit off the vine, the grapes, have been plucked. The walls that protected the vineyard have been torn down, and wild animals have ravaged. Now, I really appreciate that the author chooses the boar as the one who ravages. Because if you have never been around wild hogs, they are the most, I think it's pretty accurate, the most destructive animal you can imagine. The pigs and the little floppy-eared pink pigs that live in the stall, they're cute. Not the ones that roam the woods, right? They will eat everything. They have no regard for your crops. They have no regard for your property. They will tear up anything and everything they can to eat, and then they will leave it, and they will go on. In fact, my mom and dad have a field behind their house. It's several acres. And if you were to look, if you were to stand on the back of their house, and you were to look down on the field, right over here to the left, right? This has been like 15, 16, 17 years ago. A herd, I think they're called a sounder is the actual word, a group of hogs came in, all sizes, right? And my dad otherwise would have shot them, but there are people who live behind them, and so that's kind of out of, you can't really do that. And so they came in, about 20 of them, all different sizes, and they were there for just a couple of hours, like not even very long. And they were so destructive that for the better part of the next decade, now there's nothing planted in this field, it's just bahia grass and weeds, right? That's what it's been since that time. But they were so destructive that for the better part of the next decade, whenever my dad would go out to bush hog the field, he knew exactly where those hogs had been. Because even though more grass had grown up, the water had somewhat flattened out the rooting and upturned dirt, it still was evident where they were. So the psalmist does us a great job. When he says the boar from the forest ravages it, he means in the worst possible way. And might I add this again? The boar and pigs were not eaten in Israel. So there's a layer of uncleanness, religious or spiritual uncleanness to this as well. And so he says, the walls torn down, all the fruit's gone, the boar has come in and totally devastated the place. And then in verse 16, he adds that they have burned it. In other words, they have burned us with fire. They have cut everything down. What picture is he painting? total destruction. And we don't know what historical event this relates to, because Asaph doesn't tell us. But you and I would do well to understand this as a total war. Slash and burn, devastate everything kind of moment. And so again, in the present, Asaph sees them as totally desperate. Right? So he said, in the present, we're totally desperate. But in the distant past, it hasn't been like that. But in the near past, we've been ravaged totally. But then Asaph looks to the future and he says, but it doesn't have to be that way any longer. And in this last section, in verses 14, 15, 17, and 18, Asaph turns his gaze to the future. And what you will realize in these moments is that Asaph implores, or in these verses, that Asaph implores God to turn again toward them, to look at their helpless estate, and to once again let his hand be upon them like it has in the distant past. Then Asaph says, when God rescues them, then they will, in verse 18, they will not turn their back from him. They will, when he gives them life, they will call upon his name. So this entire psalm is a desperate plea for God to do what only God can do, which is restore them and bring them back into relationship with him. Because right now, they are far, far from it. Now, I don't think it's hard for us to make a connection in our own lives with this psalm. Because like we said at the beginning, many times our lives are not major key moments. Right? They are minor key. And hey, look, I don't know where you're at this morning. You may be going through one of these. You may be like, hey man, I felt like this week. This month. This year has been a valley year for me. That may be where you're at. Right? But Asaph speaks into those situations and says that we too can do what he did. Now, before we get into the bulk of the application portion of this message, I need you to realize two things really quickly, okay? Number one, does Asaph get an answer to the how long, O Lord, and when you gonna restore us question? He does not. He does not get an answer to the question. Right? So what should that inform us? Sometimes we're not necessarily to our question. But let me ask you a second question. Does that stop Asaph from asking? No, it does not. Let me just listen to me real quick, carefully, quickly, whatever. Listen to me. God is big enough to handle your questions. He is big enough and strong enough. You don't act like you got to protect God from your how long, O Lord. My life is in the pits. I need you right now. When are you going to wake up and show up in my life? Okay? God is big. He created the universe. Right? And you and all the billions of people that have lived on this planet, I think he's capable and big enough to handle your most pressing questions. I'm not trying to mean that your questions aren't important or they don't matter. They do, absolutely. That's what I'm trying to tell you is they do. Don't feel like you've got to protect God from your questions like he can't handle it. He can absolutely handle whatever you need to say to him. He can take it. He's big enough. But in the process, realize he's not obligated to give you the answer you want. Because like my kids in the car on the way to vacation, they want the answer to be 5 minutes. And you probably do too. Because you're tired of hearing them ask. But sometimes the answer ain't 5 minutes. Sometimes it's 2.5 more movies. And I don't know how that translates into life. But sometimes the answer is, hey, you're going to be here a little while longer. So realize that just because you don't get an answer doesn't mean God doesn't care about you. But realize that you can still ask and petition and pray and implore and urge and beg, get on your hands and knees, lay flat on the ground, prostrate before the Lord, whatever you need to do. God can handle your prayer, so keep asking. Because what we see in this passage is that God is what? A restorer of people back to the place of blessing. You don't believe that? Let's use John's gospel that we've been in for the last year as an example. In John chapter 3, what does Jesus do? He takes a religious elite, Nicodemus, who can't even understand the words of the Old Testament, even though he spent his life in them. And Jesus says, if you want to be with me, you got to be what? Born again. And so he restores his mindset to where it should be. In John 4, he takes a four times divorced woman who is sleeping with another man who's not her husband and who is an outcast from her city because she's at the well in the middle of the day getting water. And what does he do? Restores her life. In John chapter 4 again, a royal official comes up to him and says, hey, my son is ill. And from a distance of many miles away, he says, go and your son's going to be healed. And on the way, they realize that when Jesus spoke the word, the son was what? He restored the son to life. In John 5, he took a guy who was a paralytic for 38 years at the pool of Bethesda, and he told him, get up and walk. Take up your mat and walk. And what happened? The guy took up his mat and walked. He restored the use of his legs. In John 6, what did he do? He fed a potentially 15,000 person crowd with a little kid's sack lunch of pitas and sardines. He provided for their hunger. In John 7 through 9, he taught the people at the Festival of Booths that they didn't need to worry about physical thirst and physical darkness, but rather they needed to turn to that which he could give, which was spiritual food and spiritual light in their life. He taught them how to be restored back to God. And in chapter 11, what did he do in John? He took a four-day-old stone-cold dead man who was his friend and brought him back to life. Listen to me. God is in the business of restoring people just like you and me back into a place of blessing in their lives, in your life, in my life. So if God can do it for these people in John, and that's just John, we can look at the other Gospels. We can look at all of the Old Testament too. God restores people back. And here's kind of the where it works into this Christmas season is that the main way that God restores you and me back to the place of blessing is through His Son Jesus. Listen to me. The Christmas season is all, there's a lot of words. And we're going to talk, last week we talked about hope. This week we talked about restoration. Next week we're going to talk, or in future weeks we're going to talk about joy and some others. But listen to me. Christmas is about restoration because God was not obligated to send His Son into the world to be born of Mary, to be raised in the backwaters of a backwater empire, to be ridiculed, rejected, and ultimately crucified and buried. Thankfully, He rose again. But God did not have to do any of that. He didn't have to do any of it. But He did. Why? Because God is in the restoration business. And that means restoring you and me today. So listen to me. No matter how far you get off the rails, because look at me, you're going to get off the rails this next year. You might get off the rails before the end of this year. You might be off the rails today. No matter how far you get, no matter how deep the valley, no matter how loud the how long, O Lord, is going to be from you, no matter how bad your wall is broken down or that ravaging boar has ravaged your life, or no matter how bad the destruction in your personal life is or in your relationships or whatever, God is in the business of restoring you back to the place of blessing. Now, let me put a caveat on this place of blessing. I'm not going to talk about what that's going to look like. Okay? Because it's going to look different for every one of you. It's not going to be money, finances, and good health and wealth and all that. Right? But it is bringing, this whole idea is bringing us back into relationship with God, into the place of blessing. And the place of blessing is being in that relationship with the Lord. Whatever else material comes out of that is up to the Lord. Because that's not the point of this text. Now, if Asaph wanted the text to be the place of blessing as reward and riches and all that, he could have just, you know, added a little verse 20 in there. Right? But he doesn't, does he? And so the place of blessing is being in that relationship with the Lord. All the other stuff is just extra added on top. Read you one last verse and then we'll be done. Because God concludes the Bible with the same idea in Revelation chapter 21. I don't have that one on the list, do I? Oh, look at there. Way to go. Look at this quote. Now, this is from God. Revelation 21. If you're not familiar with Revelation 21, you can read it. In a couple years, we'll be there because we're going to do Revelation in 2025. She's got to hang on a minute, right? We have a few more things to get through before we get there. But look at this. Behold, I am making all things new. And I love this next line. He also said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. In other words, hey, John, write this down. I'm making all things new. What is making things new? Restoring things, which is exactly what we talked about today. So from beginning to end, Genesis to Revelation, what is God? He's a God who restores people back into relationship with Him, into the place of blessing. And that can happen in your life and in my life if we will just let it. Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.